in committing to teach some of the pieces in the book for Days of Action, whether it's in making performances more widely accessible to people. One of the wonderful things that the Voices Performance Project does is work with young people and have students also put on these performances. And it's something you can do anywhere. And so our hope is that it will be a tool for people to learn not just prior history, but really recent history and how people have fought back, how people have resisted their own conditions of oppression, and most importantly, how people have acted in solidarity because they've recognized the links between these different struggles. And that is a key theme of the book, that none of these struggles are really separate, that it actually matters that we are fighting together, and that's the way that we'll win.
Haley Pessin and Anthony Arnov, co-editors of the book Voices of a People's History of the United States in the 21st Century, Documents of Hope and Resistance. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Roddy Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining
us. This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
Farewell to you.
David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. By now, many of you have heard the landmark Supreme Court ruling. It comes a little bit more than a year after they made a groundbreaking decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. This time, they ended affirmative action, something that had been in place since 1965 and probably around the 80s became a contentious policy. So now it's dead. It's gone, whether you're in a private university or whether you're in a public university. And I have a couple of people that are been on the front lines with this fight for a very long time. We have Mike Benitez, who is a dean and deals with diversity issues and has been doing this for a while. He's out in Boulder, Colorado, or actually Denver, Colorado. And we have for a few short minutes, because he's been on the run all day, is Jeff Chang. We know Jeff as an incredible author and somebody who's addressed this issue for a very long time. Jeff, I wanted to get your response from this because of your work and what you've done around this. But now, very connivingly, if I can use that word, what they're doing is they're holding up Asian folks and making this a wedge. I just saw a press release from Black conservatives. They were cheering it on, and they were saying the reason, you know, that said our poor Asian folks have been discriminated against, and now this will correct the wrongs. And it's becoming a whole sort of, you know, they're the reasons why this is happening. Mm-hmm. How are you seeing this, Jeff?
It's a really, really dark day for education and for the country. I am, like many others, feeling devastated by the court ruling. I think that what we'll see now is the de facto resegregation of higher education. And it's because of a de jure ruling here that basically establishes a national policy that race cannot be considered in the admissions process at highly selective universities, right? So they're saying that they've done something here that is gonna remove racial discrimination. What I see happening actually is the intensification of the race gap from kindergarten through the bachelor's degree level, and the intensification and the growing of the wealth gap as well. So there's a lot in there. Let me try to unpack it real quick, right? Mm-hmm. First thing to say is, man, you and I, we've been through the trenches. We were there in the 1980s when Asian Americans were being discriminated against in the admissions process right up the road at UC Berkeley at our alma mater. And we were part of a large contingent, a multiracial contingent of folks that was fighting at that time to defend affirmative action programs as a remedy for historic exclusion of people of color and continuing underrepresentation.
Let me just be clear too, just so that we understand. At that time, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you know, the affirmative action thing, you know, was going to marginalized communities, and they were looking at Black folks and Brown folks. And then they made this gesture and said, Asians are good, right? And the argument was, well, which Asians are you talking about? Because there's a big difference between somebody who is from San Jose and Japanese and has been here for a couple of generations versus somebody who might be Laos out of Richmond, right? And so they kind of umbrellaed everybody, and that just kind of caused one ripple. But there were some other things. I'll let you continue on that, but that's what I remember with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things. But the main thing was this, right? Asian Americans had started in the 1940s. There's been a 75-year effort to establish affirmative action and equal opportunity programs that Asian Americans have stood alongside African Americans, have stood alongside Chicano, Native American, Latinx folks arguing for affirmative action. There's a brief period in the 1970s where Asian Americans needed to be in these programs in order to remedy this historic exclusion. And then by the 1980s, what you have is a whole new generation of folks coming in, a large contingent of Asian Americans coming in because of the 1965 Immigration Act that are then applying to public universities, right? And what we saw was, at that time, they removed Asian Americans from affirmative action and recruitment and retention programs for the most part. There were a couple of other programs for Southeast Asians, for Pacific Islanders still, for Filipino Americans, to be able to remedy the underrepresentation and the historic exclusion of those communities. But what we had was most Asian Americans competing directly with white students for slots at the University of California, right? Mm. And this is supposedly supposed to be a colorblind meritocratic process. But what they did, what universities like UCLA, UC Berkeley, Stanford, Harvard, Brown, Yale, a bunch of universities did, was actually tinker with the system to actually exclude Asian Americans, to basically exclude Asian Americans disproportionately in relationship to this competition. So what that proved to us was, A, you're talking about a colorblind system. It's not colorblind. B, you're talking about merit being colorblind and a way to measure everybody equally. It's not. It's fungible. People can change that stuff to exclude folks anytime they want to, right? Third, if you want to talk about a colorblind meritocracy, we obviously didn't have that. If we had underrepresentation of historically excluded people of color, and you had discrimination against Asian Americans in this process. And so it exposed these universities as not using colorblind merit, and it exposed this this myth of colorblindness in the meritocracy. Now, the thing that Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, says in her dissent, which is blazing and which everybody needs to read, in her very first sentence or her very first paragraphs, is this is a country that's never been colorblind. And so we need race-conscious admissions policies to be able to remedy that, right? And instead, what the justices have done, Justice Sotomayor said, is they've established a standard here, a national standard now, of colorblindness, for enforced colorblindness, like they have in France, which is a whole other story, but enforced colorblindness that's actually going to lead us into educational apartheid by the end of the century. Because what we have is, in a K-12 system, we have increasing resegregation of the schools. Whites continue to be stubbornly the most segregated group of all, right? 75% of white students go to 75% white schools. Okay. And it's getting worse. And so even during this period where we have increasing diversity, where the US is supposed to become a majority minority nation within the next decade, what we have is increasing school segregation from the K-12 level. And now we have the ban on the only tool that allows us to be able to undo underrepresentation and remedy historic exclusion of Black and brown students. And so resegregation is going to extend to the higher education level, and we're going to see educational apartheid by the end of the century if we don't get on after it.
It's interesting. As you were talking, we just got a text. Big shout out to Jill Christina, you know, who's a local activist. And just as you were talking, said we're headed back to Jim Crow, because this ruling is not by itself. And I think that's real important for people to look at, that alongside this ruling is the removal of, you know, African-American classes in a whole bunch of states. It's legal discrimination around gay and trans folks. It's halting the type of remedies that were put into place to help our indigenous brothers and sisters. So all this is happening, and they're happening the way they're being framed is if they're, you know, one-off. Well, that's just a gay problem. That's just a Black problem. That's just an Asian problem. But it's all coming from the same mindset and institutions, and they're attacking everybody all at once. Mike Benitez, I mentioned, you know, he's also been busy all day with this. You have made your name known throughout academia for the work you do in DEI, diversity, exclusion, and what is the other one? Integration? DEI? Inclusive.
Inclusion, right?
Yeah, inclusion, yeah. And you're serving as a dean now in Colorado.
Vice president.
Right. How are you seeing this? We just saw you in Encore. We were, you know, all of us were down at a national conference in New Orleans. You gave a lot of workshops. And so this was something that I think you saw coming down the pipe. And many people there saw it coming down the pipe, but it's nevertheless not, you know, still shocking, still jarring. But at this point, with this now, you know, enshrined, how are you seeing the political landscape?
No, you know, I agree with literally everything Jeff said. And, you know, what's unfortunate, even as I've taken on a bit of interviews throughout the day, is that folks are struggling to wrestle with the deeper conversation that this represents with respect to power, control, policy, you know, white supremacist systems. And not like the white supremacy that cats be talking about, the KKK or neo-Nazis, right? Like the foundation of a system that's grounded in white epistemic knowledge production and construction type of thinking, right? Who's making the decisions? Who gets to dictate? I wasn't, like a lot of people, and to your point, surprised. Jeff brings up some really important historical gems, and then I want to, you know, right offer that we go beyond that in the political landscape, because there's an element to this around affirmative action that, yes, to some degree grants access, but nobody's talking about Nobody's talking about a space cultivation, right? Nobody's talking about, you know, what is the evolution of affirmative action? Where has it come since the Kennedy era? Where has it come since before the Kennedy era? And all the different groups, Asian American and a community, the Black and African American community, the Hispanic, Latina, Latina, Latino, Latinx, you know, now we have, you know, community. You know, there's a rumble in there, but there's also a relational positionality that we need to be attentive to around who was able to benefit from affirmative action in ways that allowed something like assimilation or acculturation to be something that they could take up in space, and who didn't have that privilege. So the idea of who this really benefits, and we could look at the data going back and know that white women have benefited the most. Right. Let's just say writ large, by egons in number, and yeah, we can make the arguments around this place was never, you know, colorblind. And I'm trying to step back right to that foundation and fundamentalism of a colorblind meritocracy. But then the post-colonial scholar in me also wants to do justice to the more, you know, kind of critical impact of divide and conquer, right? The way Ed Blum, for example, is rolling up on in here saying, oh, this is how it impacts Asian Americans. He has no vested interest in Asian Americans' growth, culture, progression. And neither has affirmative action really hit a big dent in the way that we think it has. And I'm glad that Jeff actually said that, you know, highly selective institutions and what they've done, because at Metro State University of Denver, we're in open access. I'm having to right now stand in alignment and solidarity with other institutions that this is going to impact. We're open access. We're not worried about affirmative action is not going to impact us. But it does put the onus on institutions of higher education, especially private 4 years, private 4 year selectives, public 4 year selectives, to have to own the onus and responsibility without relying on this black and white affirmative action, a policy and the law surrounding it that make it possible for, you know, people of color to gain, you know, entry and access into higher education. And so even though I think this is horrible, this is truly a horrible moment for the United States. That I agree with. I also want to offer up that even within the context of affirmative action over the last 60 years, we've still had to struggle and navigate and negotiate and wrestle and fight for our different communities, even with affirmative action in place. Now, this is going to make it a lot harder. And I do agree with the de facto segregation that actually is not going to happen. It's been happening ever since charter schools became a thing, ever since state-related universities, right? Because there's, and that's what I mean, people have to understand the difference between a public university and a public-related university and how those are tied to federal and state dollars. And if we don't understand that, we're not going to be able to delineate and discern between who has that power, who's getting that federal support, and who's holding institutions to shackles to some degree around what policies they can make or not make with respect to access. But nobody's even talking about the reality that we've evolved from affirmative action as a redressing, mending as a result of historical exclusion, discrimination in a legal way, to institutions today making arguments around how diversifying is enriching the learning environment and academic excellence, where everyone can benefit because of A, B, and C, right? Access to each other, the conversations, or engaging with difference, and all that discourse and jargon that comes with it, but it still has a place. And I say that to say that we can have this conversation around affirmative action and impact without having a conversation around outcomes. So even if you look at California and Florida, who are two of the states that actually have done a decent job getting past no longer being able to use race conscious admissions, or the nine other states that are not doing as well, where affirmative action has been eliminated altogether already before this decision happened, we're not exactly seeing the success, especially among Latino students, Black students. And I love the delineation of Asian communities. You have, you know, Asian communities who may come from places of some wealth, right? I'm not going to call it privilege. There's nothing privileged about just being non-white in the U.S. at all, you know, but you can't put those alongside Filipino or Thai or Cambodian communities who would be, in my eyes, kind of considered sort of the Black of Asia, right? The sort of the undesirable, or the they're not Japan, they're not China, they're not Korea, they're not South Korea, right? They're not those kind of dominant identities in Asia that we think about. So without looking at that complexity and that nuance, we're missing such a big part of the political landscape, because a lot of these institutions that use affirmative action are actually not graduating at least 30 to 40% of their students of color anyway once they get in.
Right. That's the voice of Mike Benitez. We also have Jeff Chang for a few minutes on the show this afternoon. Jeff, as you were talking about the notion of colorblindness, it appears to me that the attempt is to make everything colorblind, so then you can, in very private ways, in very clandestine ways, exercise discrimination and then hold your hands up and say, I don't see color. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no pattern. There's nothing systemic about what I did. It's, you know, we got rid of Jeff Chang because Jeff Chang just wasn't good for the job. And we're not going to look at all the other Changs that we got rid of, you know, at the same time. Right. So, you know, and so they're putting these things into law. And I want to come back to this because, one, the language that you're seeing in other things that are being put into place is you can't talk about things from a systemic standpoint. That was the whole fight around CRT, you know, critical race theory. Can't talk about things. There are no patterns. This is just individual failures and success. That's one thing. The other thing is within the university itself, me and Jeff both went to Cal Berkeley, and a law firm in Colorado, where you're at, Mike Benitez, is now suing Cal Berkeley because we had Black graduation. So it seems to me that this is a test case to do one of two things. See if it sticks and it can get some traction. Then they can go all around the country and knock that out. Or two, create a firestorm where the universities themselves would say, you know what, we're getting too much heat. Why don't we just kind of not have these Black graduations, Brown graduations, just everybody graduate and call it a day. So Jeff, you want to speak on that? I'm not sure if that's something that's hit on your, you know, on some of the things that you're doing right now.
No, absolutely. It's, you know, this is, I've been talking to a lot of university lawyers, actually.
Several
months. And everybody's like, what's the ruling going to look like, right? Is it going to mean that we're going to actually have lawsuits here against minority targeted scholarships? Does it mean that we're going to have lawsuits to ban Black houses or Asian American houses? Does it mean that we're going to have lawsuits that are going to ban Black fraternities or Asian fraternities and sororities, right? Does it mean that we're going to have a ban on freshman bridge programs, pre-freshman bridge programs? Wow. Does it mean we're going to have like bans on Black graduations and Asian American graduations? And I'm talking to the lawyers on this, and the lawyers today are saying that, no, we think it's going to apply narrowly to admissions, just to university admissions. But you never know. The lawyers will also tell you, look, people might be able to come out and file these lawsuits and say that Black graduations violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
Just like affirmative action programs or race as a tip in admissions does. right? And folks will come up with arguments around that kind of stuff. So I think that university lawyers are actually going to be bracing over the next few years to see just how this all shakes out. And we, of course, have to take this back to the point that you're making, Davey, about the climate that we're in, which is, look, we had a black president, and then we had Donald Trump. We had the George Floyd protests, and then we had the white lash against that. And we're living in the aftermath of that, and it's intensifying. And the real thing is the majority-minority piece in the next decade.
Right.
So these culture wars aren't going to go away. These lawsuits aren't going to go away. It's going to be a rough ride. And I think that what we are doing now is we're setting ourselves up to go in the wrong direction within the law. Now, what that means is, and this is where I'm down with like Mike on this, right, is basically we're going to have to get really, really creative within the kinds of parameters that we're being given. And we always have been. That's our history, right? Those are our histories right there. But that's what we're going to have to really do is we're going to have to really think about what solidarity means. And we're going to have to really think about what it means to be able to overturn this particular piece. Make people realize, right, that this was a mistake on the level of Dred Scott. So I think that that's like the long-term piece. And we have to think, I think, in terms of the long-term play as well as the short-term play around this. And I just really appreciate being able to rock with you guys today on a day like this.
Jeff Chang, we appreciate you dropping in and sharing with us. We have Mike Benitez here. We're also joined by Gay Teresa Johnson.
Hey, Jeff, good to kick it, brother. Good to see you.
She's a scholar in her own right down at UCLA. Gay, how are you?
I'm great. I'm actually like I couldn't pass up the opportunity to be in conversation with y'all, even though I'm driving in LA. So I'm just like I'm not on camera, but I'm here. I'm listening and learning from y'all. And hi, Jeff, and hi, Mike. It's great to see you all.
Let me ask you this.
It's good to. I'm glad you could join us. That's peace.
You've been on the front line in a lot of this, especially with the work you do about, you know, around black and brown solidarity. How do you see this affecting, say, the students that you teach? You're over at UCLA. Is the conversation of affirmative action something that resonates with people? Do they really understand the significance, the fights that were fought, or is this just the word that has been tossed around? And I only ask that because I've run into an increasing number of students of color who've actually been like, yeah, you know, it's no big deal. You know, I'll figure it out, right? And, you know, maybe that's a good attitude to have if they feel like, you know, they can figure it out, or maybe they don't understand why they're there in the first place. So Gay, how are you seeing the landscape?
I feel like, you know, this is the thing about history and time is that we think we're just in this one period of time when, like, as if this decision today doesn't have a history in both the resistance that we've mounted to it over many years, especially here in California, and also the history of the Republicans having this. They've been mobilizing and doing this very targeted attack on affirmative action since the Reagan administration, and there's so much there on both sides. And you know, this is a moment when a lot of the struggles that we're looking at, people perceive them in very individual terms, but it is absolutely a collective issue and a collective fight, because it's affirmative action and there's so much around that. There's so much history in just this one policy, but also we have to think about who the Supreme Court is right now, and who they're aligned with in terms of the Republican majority and majoritarian like rule. They're absolutely aligning themselves with what they perceive to be the majority politics, even though most people did not want affirmative action to be overturned. It what matters is that they are aligning themselves with what they feel is the right. And so today it's affirmative action, and there's all kinds of ramifications about this, but it's also part of the Roe v. Wade stuff. It's also part of everything that Jeff was just talking about. And I know you've dropped some gems, Mike. I'm sorry, I didn't hear earlier, but it's all of these things together around the banning of transgender care. All of this stuff is part of the same movida of aligning themselves with a Republican administration. And so I'm seeing this in a broader context, but also to answer your question, I think there's a lot of folks that are not encouraged to look at it in this sort of long historical view. So
I appreciate that. That's the voice of gay Teresa Johnson. I think we just lost her for a second. She's driving in LA, but she teaches in UCLA. We have Mike Benitez, and we are also being joined by Natasha Wilkins. She's educator, engagement manager for the National Center for Youth Laws Education. So, Natasha, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. We got Gay back. Appreciate that. Were you surprised about this hearing for the work that you're doing? But I would imagine as a lawyer or working, you know, with the youth law, that you all were probably like, yeah, this is going to be coming down the pipe. As I said earlier, we just got back from a conference. We were at the NCORE conference, Mike and myself, and this was a topic du jour, right? But it still was shocking and jarring to hear it. But from a lawyer's standpoint, how have you all been seeing this?
Yeah, and great to be on the show. So I'll say from the lawyer's perspective, we weren't too surprised to hear it. But one thing that I've been hearing and that we've been hearing as advocates in this space is that this is the end of affirmative action. And I do want to say that that's actually not true. I don't know what the conversation has been up to this point, but I do want to say that there's a lot of danger in overextending what actually came out in this opinion. And so for everybody listening, for everybody thinking about this, I do want to be clear that we need to make sure that we are nuanced in our understanding of what this opinion means and what it does not mean. Because what a lot of the headlines are saying right now is actually not what this opinion means.
So where do you think people are getting it wrong? Because I read it and I was like, it's over. I poured a little liquor out on the court and was like...
Gave your libations.
Yeah.
So I think where people are missing the nuance is in the fact that, first of all, this opinion actually only applies to the admissions policies for UNC and for Harvard. There are potential implications for other universities that use race-conscious admissions, but this holding actually does not in and of itself impact any other school except these two schools and their policies. And so that's the very first thing we need to understand. It's a very limited holding. The second thing we need to understand when we are thinking about what these cases mean and what these holdings don't mean is that students are still allowed to talk about race in their applications. Students can still talk about how race has impacted them, how their race has either has shaped them, has influenced the way that they move about the world, has matured them, has had positive impacts, negative impacts. Students can and should continue to talk about how race has impacted their lives when they are filling out their college admissions packets. And so although universities cannot specifically think about race and say, we are going to consider race for the sake of race in your application, students still are 100% allowed to talk about who they are and how race has played a role in shaping them.
Natasha,
if I may, Dave, Natasha says, I'm so glad that you brought that nuance up. That's so important. And even as I'm interviewing with folks, I see that folks who don't have a deep understanding of affirmative action, its history, its evolution, the way different states, as because they can kind of have their own statuses that they can do their own thing and within the federal policy and laws, but still that can go a little bit different way, is the conflation of race, ethnicity to not only diversity writ large, but it's also the conflation of race and ethnicity. you know, folks can even define those two separately. And I do agree that if we understand, you know, that one, even within the context of affirmative action, we've had to navigate, negotiate, wrestle, figure things out in ways that we somehow assume affirmative action just gives access and way to, right? Mm-hmm. That's one. Two, if we can move forward, and I guess I'm approaching this not from a place of this is not bad. This is a horrible ruling. Let me be clear on that. But it's nothing new. We've been in the pendulum for some time. And then lastly, if institutions can still define diversity within what they are aiming to accomplish to diversify their campus community, there's still immense possibility and hope that we can look at, notwithstanding the horrible, significant decision that this is, because now, right, it just kind of takes away that protection that takes away accountability and transparency too, but institutions can still take it with them themselves to own that onus of how are they going to achieve. There's a lot of institutions that still, you know, do it, Davey. And to the question that you asked before around the culture wars or what we're hearing, yeah, there's quite a bit of panic. There is quite a bit of, what are we going to do? But we've been, our ancestors and us and those before us have been running this game and having to engage the critical trade-offs in praxis and action and in teaching, not only prior to affirmative action, throughout affirmative action, and we're going to continue to do so in this post-affirmative right. action, even though with its limitations, to Natasha's points.
Well, let me ask all of you this. That was the voice of Mike Benitez. We also have Natasha Wilkins. We also have Gay Teresa Johnson. We know that many of the laws that have been passed over the past 4 or 5 years, post-Trump, Trump and afterwards, are really situated around this fear of a black and a browning of America. That's what this is all about. You know, there's a bunch of people that have been trying to hold power, and they're realizing that the power is slipping. And I have an old saying that when you see folks acting like this, you turn up even more, right? Could the ultimate solution be that people turn up and really be like, you know what? I'm going to make it my absolute business as a revolutionary act, right? Against all cause, I'm going to bust my butt and get nothing but straight A's, A pluses. If you're saying that it's about meritocracy, I'm going to be at the top of the class. And we dominate that the way that we have been able to dominate in sports and other arenas. Is that a possibility? Is that something that is giving too much leverage and ignoring systemic issues of power? Or do we just tell our kids, you are better than them? We absolutely expect, you know, I'm telling my kids, y'all better show up with A's. You know, ain't no C's and B's in the house. So that's one question. And Natasha, I want you to answer that. But as a lawyer, Can you and some of your other lawyer friends all get together and start suing these universities for having legacy programs? You know, so you have folks that are walking into the university half drunk, as far as I'm concerned, underqualified, but their daddy got a wing named after them, so they get to come to the university, you know, or their parents went to school. So they, you know, these legacy programs, is that a form of affirmative action? So anybody can hit those questions first. Maybe I'll get you, Gay. Since you're teaching, can you get your kids? Are they in a mindset to be like, you know what, no matter what, as a revolutionary act, as an act of black excellence, brown excellence, we're going to bust our butt and get A's and be better than anybody out there?
I love this question, and I also love the kind of implicit caveat you gave, which was like, or is systemic, you know, inequality also a factor here? And I think it is. I mean, I like the idea of the encouragement that we give our children, which I think is a tradition that is well rooted in all of our histories of black and brown folks, is to understand basically the terms of engagement with the United States and the meritocracy that it is, and in many ways, like, best them at those rules. And knowing what we know about gentrification, about redlining, what we know about food deserts, what we know about transportation segregation and the recession and income inequality and all of the things, also understanding that those pressures are also a huge factor in whether or not a student can succeed. Not just a huge factor, the determining factor. Hunger is one. And also just the state of segregation, the fact that more Latinos now are going to more segregated schools now than they did in 1968. This is not something that has gotten better. So we keep that in mind as we also, and as our parents and our grandparents, we follow in that tradition as well of things that sometimes in some modes can be problematic, but also are a strategy to create a level and a standard of entrance into this society to get what we deserve. But the other thing I was just going to say is that I was going to say that another thing that I think we are often not talking about are the material differences between the education that white private schools get and public schools get. And I mean that for everybody that's enrolled in these schools. And I've had a little bit of experience with seeing what private schools can do and do for their students. And we're talking about an incredible amount of resourcing and networking that is exactly how, I mean, I think we talk about this in our like graduate schools of ed, and we talk about this in textbooks, but how does it really happen? It really happens when private schools invite whole panels of people who are deans of admission to come and present to their students in high school about what to write in their personal statements, and how that doesn't happen for especially low-income public schools. But the thing to remember is how we have, without even knowing all the time what were the means for success and entrance, we have still tried to provide those things in our communities for each other and for our children by right. trying to create quiet study spaces and public study spaces and liberating libraries for public spaces. So what I hope is that we continue in that tradition of that practice, not even often knowing how to make a way, but making a way.
Gay Teresa Johnson, professor down at UCLA, I appreciate you sharing that. Natasha, I want to get your thoughts on this. But before you do, I just want to add a little something to this. As you were talking, Gay, and knowing that they're putting this lawsuit around Black graduations, and there may be a threat to try and eliminate, you know, Black fraternities and things like that. I spent a lot of time DJing at many of the white fraternities at Cal, and I got a chance to really see, to your point, Gay, about resources. I've been at some of those houses where sitting senators were at the dinner table with some of these folks, you know. I was at these houses where they had not just the alumni, but they had entire networks of midterms and finals and thesis and all these things that, you know, that were available. And they also had that network. Hey, you know, your uncle or your dad's best friend is in the country club. Why don't you come on out here on a Saturday and hang out at the pool? And I'm going to introduce you literally to the dean of admission. So some of those fraternities that are, you know, these predominantly white fraternities, they had not just a lot of resources, but they had these very entrenched and very powerful connections. You know, to the point it's like, damn, I should join them if I want to get ahead. And some of the folks that I got to meet were very clear that if they wanted to get ahead, they needed to be a member of a fraternity A, Y, and B, because the networking was going to be the pillar or the determining factor of their success. Like, I got to meet the president of Bank of America. That's how I'm getting my job, and that's how I'm getting ahead. But that may go back to how that may translate when we're in high school and middle high school. So just some food for thought. Natasha, let me toss that to you, the question, and also, do you sue these legacy things?
Yeah, so the first thing that I want to say, I'm going to keep reiterating this point, is that the holding is limited. So this does not apply to extracurriculars. There's not going to be a threat to our Black fraternities and sororities. The Divine Nine on our campuses will be fine. Again, this is a very limited decision. Next thing I want to say is, before I became an attorney, I was a high school history teacher. I taught African American history. And So your question around, like, is this just a matter of telling our kids, be the best, be at the top? Our kids are already doing that. I've seen my students do amazing things with the limited resources they have. To Gay's point, my school was severely underfunded, severely under-resourced. We didn't have a library, and my students were doing what they could with what they were given. And so I just want to make it clear for all of our Black and Brown students that you still deserve to be in these spaces. You still have every right to apply to any school that you want to go to. Your race will not limit you from being able to apply. Talk about your race. Talk about how being a Black or Brown student has caused whatever additional challenges, if you face those. If they've not, talked about resilience and how you excelled and went beyond, even with all these statistics and things saying that you should not have achieved. And that is why you deserve to be in these spaces. Mm-hmm. That is still 100% valid, and you should, by all means, be doing that. So to all the students, I want to encourage them to not feel defeated by this, to not feel like you're now going to have an extra barrier. You are not, this does not prevent you from doing anything that you were already doing. The way your application shows up, what you can put in there, this does not change anything for what students can put on their applications. Another thing I want to address before I get to the legacy piece is just that also when we're thinking about what this means and who should be doing what to move us forward and make sure we stay on the track to justice and equity within our institutions of higher education, universities should be working with our communities to make sure that they are engaging in substantial outreach and recruitment in underserved communities. To Gay's point about who's coming in and teaching the students what universities are looking for, universities can go into schools and do that very same thing. You don't have to have the connections to folks at the table and who's over here and who's over there. Universities in their outreach centers should be going into our communities and recruiting our students. Another call to action for universities is, in addition to the recruitment part of admissions, we encourage universities to make sure that their comprehensive policies around admissions then also extend into the supports they offer students once students are in the university. So it's not just about getting kids in, but it's about getting them in and making sure that they feel valued, heard, and seen once they are in your school. To your legacy question, there's already work being done around that. There were many amicus briefs that addressed this issue of legacy admissions. It's something like, I believe, and I don't want to say this wrong, so I'll double check this and make sure I'm right, but I believe it's something like 40% of Harvard's white applicants are legacy, or 40% of Harvard's white admits are legacy students. And so there is a serious issue when we are talking about who is being led into these spaces and who is not, when we think about the impact and the role of legacy admissions. And I do want to add to that, as I say that when we think about affirmative action, because it's being characterized as something that is exclusionary, when you look at the history and the point of affirmative action, the point of what came out of Brown versus Board, the goal there was to expand the pie. It was to include people who had been historically excluded. And so when we think about the role of affirmative action, it is not something that is being done to keep anyone out. It's being done to let everyone in.
Natasha Wilkinson, we appreciate your words of wisdom. That's why you get the big bucks coming in here, just slaying things. So thank you. For first of all, the nuance and giving us that understanding and reminding us that all of us can get caught up in the headlines of doom and gloom, and there's more than one way to skin a cat, if you will, you know. And so you know, we'll just figure it out and make it happen, and this ain't the end of the fight. It ain't over. And I think those who would like us to think it's the end of the fight might be posturing. You know, let me hit you real hard and act like it's over. Nah, son, I'm still standing, and now I'm about to hit back. So, Mike, I want to let you get the last word. I know you have to go. And so, first of all, Natasha, how do we get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you can reach me at the National Center for Youth Law. I can share my email address. It's nwilkins@youthlaw.org. You can also find us at the Education Civil Rights Alliance. If you're looking for the brief that we submitted on this, because we did submit an amicus brief. So if you want to read our brief, you can just Google Education Civil Rights Alliance amicus brief for these cases and read what we had to say and what the students that we interviewed had to say. You can also reach us on Twitter and Facebook.
Appreciate that. And Mike, let you wrap things up. Anything you want to leave us with? And thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, if the hailing gets insane, because it's hailing over here, my window is smack against the hail hitting it, let me know. So
Mike is in Colorado.
Yeah. So I'm going to say this. I'm really appreciating a lot of what Natasha is bringing up. It matters in the conversation because what she's describing as the limits of this decision and where else we can go with it is really where we're at. Now, does this open to your opening point a possibility for nationalizing, right? And for different states and institutions of higher ed to begin to test themselves how far they can take this if they want to be that racist? absolutely. Is it officially carved out in stone and formalized in policy? No. Right. And even institutions like UNC or Harvard can think of other ways to go beyond race consciousness and admissions. But the points brought up around community outreach and targeting and working with communities and certain schools to get around this, or different initiatives and efforts outside of admissions process that are linked to like TRIO programs, CAMP programs, EOE programs, or even to the point of fraternities and sororities or support systems are going to stay in place. And the piece around being able to speak to your experiences and your different identities matters. And I want to echo that. I want to echo Natasha and Gabe from a place of our students should not see themselves as unworthy. Go for it. Go for it all. But I do want to add this, and this is maybe where I depart from a lot of my fans and my peoples, and that is, you know, I think we need to start reframing the conversation a little bit around where do you want to be and who wants you? Why do we continue to give institutions of illusional prestige this props, this demagogue props, and keep going there and putting, you know, ourselves through this experiences of not belonging, unwantingness, always having to push against the grain? And how are we beginning to make decisions of selecting to go to institutions and states and places that actually welcome and embrace? And I'm not saying that there's a utopia there. I'm not saying that these places are all in. What I'm saying is that how can we have agency as a people of color in solidarity and as other marginalized and underrepresented identities in higher education? How can we come in solidarity to your point of action to make a very particular stand of collective voice around where we choose and how we choose to go to educate? And can there be enough economic impact at those institutions? Can they feel it in a way, not only from a finance standpoint, but also from not having the richness that diversity offers at our respective institutions, so that folks will say, hey, I'm not going to, you know, go there, right? But, you know, I want to lean and I want to lean on that hope. And I really echo Natasha is saying it's not the off and all, is this is not the end. And to your question, it's both and. I think there's a stand that we can take, but we also can do it at the detriment of losing our lives. I mean, you're talking about a nation that passed laws like drapetomania. You're talking about a nation that passed laws like what's that other one? Fugitive Slave Act,
right?
You know, we're talking about a nation that truly wasn't built for us by us, and we're only 70 literally years removed from some of the major decisions that allowed us to finally enter spaces. So we're right And I have to write, we're right at the beginning. So if we turn the conversation to one of ownership, then we could, I think we could have a better collective control, understanding, right, and impact.
Mike Benitez, I appreciate that. And Natasha, I'm going to let you say your last piece because you wanted to make sure we were clear about something. So go ahead.
Thank you for that. So I know I've been saying we need to make sure we understand the nuance of this opinion, but I do also want to make clear that this is a horrible decision. This decision is absolutely atrocious. It undermines over 45 years of precedent, and it's so horrible because it seeks to uphold the idea of race blindness in admissions, but race blindness does not reflect the reality of our society and the experiences of our students. And so for that reason, this decision is absolutely atrocious, and we should be appalled that the Supreme Court would move in this direction.
Well, there you have it. All four of our guests, Jeff Chang, Gay Teresa Johnson, Natasha Wilkins, and Mike Benitez, are all in agreement. I wish you all were on the court, because this wouldn't have passed. But, you know, we're going to make a way out of no way in spite of. So thank you very much. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, radio, South, man. Conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. We have never known more about the ocean than we do today. The Nippon Foundation and others are dedicated to mapping 100% of the ocean floor. Various major foundations have tripled down on support of marine science, particularly in marine protected areas worldwide. But despite all, progress has proven slow, not just for lack of resources, but for the various standing organizations doing the research and allocating or receiving the funds. The UN sits at the apex of the international structure. The two primary subsets in the United States are, first, the national government organizations, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the National Science Foundation, and second, the universities, institutes, and certain large non-governmental organizations with special interest and capacity. Available funds are specifically targeted, often multi-year, competitive, peer-reviewed, and published in academic journals, occasionally amplified by conference, the press, and social media. My inbox receives a constant stream of such reports and results and invitations where this work is shared almost exclusively with other scientists and policymakers in a delimited digital echo chamber of incremental progress with occasionally a dramatic discovery. I call this collective endeavor the Ocean Apparat. The apparat has its own sense of time, its own esoteric language, its own competitiveness, its own meetings, its own rituals, its own acolytes, its own hierarchy and exclusivity that is not particularly interested or motivated to share the records and revelations beyond itself, a press release, a newsletter announcement, or to reward an occasional rebel who attempts to reach outside the chamber to the public, to you and me, who are the underlying financiers and overlying beneficiaries of the entire endeavor. The apparat has its own complex architecture, divided into silos and substructures by scientific interest, discipline, geography, and patronage. Regardless of intent, it is a tightly enclosed circle. How might it change? Here are some ideas. First, all grants must be cross-cutting. That is, built into the proposal team and budget, they must include interdisciplinary connection, multiple points of view, evinced by the interests and the institutional identity of the investigators and the intended outcomes. The research is focused, but the team must be additionally inclusive of scientific disciplines, diverse identity and location, as indicative of a process that conjoins pure science with social perspectives and insists on a communication strategy that reaches other experts and policymakers, educators, and curious individuals through broad, accessible public distribution. What if funding proposals included such individuals, qualified in such expertise, that would add interpretations to the research results, suggestions for additional inquiry, or applications for use? What if every grant required a secondary school educator to be part of the team and some form of curricular outcome to be part of the final evaluation? What if every grant required a journalist or an artist to track the research experience in narrative and visualization that would enable the investigators to explain their methods, their challenges and frustration, their explanations and speculations as means to extend and enrich their experience? In his famous 1959 Reed lecture, the English novelist C.P. Snow lamented the modern separation of, quote, the two cultures, science from the arts, the two fundamental poles of human intellectual activity. In the apparatus described, that separation persists. In a system as interconnected as the ocean, what if we advanced a similarly integrated response to research questions posed and to the larger, related challenges we face through the reconciliation of this false dichotomy, through a humanizing process that opens the apparatus to successful connection and communication within and with us all? Another positive step toward rescue. R for renewal, E for environment, S for society, C for collaboration, U for understanding, and E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org, where the full catalog of World Ocean Radio episodes is now searchable by theme. Find the Rescue Series by clicking on the Solutions banner.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Tune in at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.